Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. On college campuses all across the country, the mental health of students is a growing concern. And if you go to those places and you talk to people who work in the counseling centers, you will get a lot of anecdotal evidence. At least people will tell you what they think is going on their campus. But for a long time now, it's been difficult to say anything more global about what we know about the national student population and trying to answer questions like how many students today experience depression, how many experience anxiety, how many of them are taking some kind of medication. And then, of course, there's the larger question, how well do schools respond to the needs of students? In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be trying to get at some of the answers to these questions. At least we'll be talking with someone who is been involved in an effort aimed at getting answers to these questions. And our guest is Ben Locke. He's at Penn State, where he serves as the executive director of the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health. And we'll be talking about the results of a survey that were just published recently that took into account information that was gathered at more than 130 college campuses across the country, including this one, the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. Other Illinois schools are included. Other Big Ten schools are included. This was the report of the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health. It's a pilot study, so I'm sure that they would say that this is a matter of ongoing research, but as I say, it's an effort to try to get at this question. Well, what really can we say about the mental health of college students today? As we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and we will pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that in their questions and comments, they try to be as brief as they can so we can keep moving along, get in as many callers as possible. But certainly, people who are listening, you're welcome to call and participate in the conversation. Once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and a toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Locke, hello.
Hi, pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Maybe just talk for a minute about the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health and what it's all about.
Okay. So the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health, and I'll just abbreviate that to CSCMH, is kind of the new kid on the block in terms of trying to get at what's actually happening with college student mental health, but we're taking a fundamentally different approach to trying to gauge these issues. We're specifically focusing on students who are seeking services at counseling centers on campuses. And historically, you know, as you alluded to in your introduction, there's been a lot of a growing perception that the prevalence and severity of mental health illness issues on campus are getting worse. But there has been no kind of accurate, objective, sort of boots-on-the-ground data. And so our approach is to kind of about 5 years ago, we started a dialogue with counseling centers to see if we could get them to agree to gather the same information about the client seeking services. The real strength of counseling centers is that they tend to gather really good information about their clients, but they were gathering different kinds, and so it wasn't comparable. So through the course of that, we had about 100 counseling centers that were helped to define a standardized data set that would be used for routine clinical service students coming in the door. And then we partnered with the largest vendor that provides electronic health records or mental health records scheduling for counseling centers. And we built a standardized data set directly into the software that's used for day-to-day business. So instead of asking centers to do a secondary form of data collection above and beyond their typical service, they just go ahead and do their day-to-day business, but in the course of doing that, a good side effect is this high-quality standardized data. And then we worked to define a process where the data is de-identified, it's anonymous, and then it's pooled nationally for the purpose of analysis. And just to illustrate this idea of this being a fundamentally different method, the best analogy would be the National Weather Service. So if you're trying to predict the weather nationally and you have 100 points of measurement around the country, and you put your request out for the latest weather measurements, and you only get 27 out of 100 that respond, you're going to have a really hard time building a weather map of the country. And most research done on mental health issues is done by survey research, where you put out a request for people to answer your questions, and response rates are typically in the mid-20s, around 25, 26, 27%. But the people who don't respond are actually very, very important for understanding what's actually going on. So this project is not a survey. It's actually described as kind of mental health informatics, where we're measuring the population of students moving through mental health services at the campuses that are participating. Mm-hmm. And this pilot study was a kind of a one-time, let's see if this infrastructure works, can we get it to go? We had data coming in from 66 centers out of about 137 that are part of the project.
Now, I know, as you say, this is a part of an ongoing effort.
Right.
There are many more. I'm sure there's much more information that you would like to have and questions that you would like to have answered. But mm-hmm. so having said that, I'm sure that some people would say, well, this might well give you a pretty good idea about what's going on with students who actually go into counseling centers looking for assistance. It does not take into account those students who might be having difficulties and for whatever reason, either they're not sure where to go or they're not comfortable with saying that they have a problem and they need help, or you know, for the variety
Absolutely.
Of reasons.
Yep.
Can you take this data and with some level of confidence generalize from the population of students who seek help to the larger student population?
Well, you can extrapolate based on some other existing research, but that's not really our area of focus. Our real area of interest here is, can we accurately describe the nature of students seeking services, with the argument being that counseling centers might be the most sensitive point for increases in mental health. So it's if you compare our studies to some other work that has been done, it appears as if counseling centers tend to see rates at 2 to 3 to 4 times higher the general student body, depending on what aspect of mental health you're looking at. So in a sense, it's a very concentrated or sensitive point of measurement. So if depression increases campus-wide, the counseling center level of depression is going to increase significantly, and you're going to be able to capture that. So part of the idea is that we're not trying to measure the student body as a whole, but that we are going to be able to detect changes relatively easily through the counseling center.
I have a caller I want to get to, so I want to make sure that person knows I'm not going to make them wait forever. But just one more quick question. I'm interested in your response, going back to your statement that that there was this growing perception, and it's something certainly that we've seen in popular media, there was this growing perception that the problem of student mental health was getting worse. I mean, in the sense that maybe more students were having difficulties, or the difficulties that they were having were greater, or that also So there's been a lot written about the fact that now we have students who actually come with issues, perhaps come with medication they've been taking for some time,
mm-hmm.
So the question is, well, this growing perception that the problem is getting worse, was that perception correct?
I think the answer is yes, and to sort of contextualize that a little bit, the problem has been that the folks providing services have been saying for years, things feel like they're getting worse. There's more people with more severe problems, but we haven't actually been able to document whether or not that's the case, with really one exception, a study out of Kansas State in 2003, which was able to describe this kind of spike in depression, anxiety, assaults, things of that nature. But what this study clearly shows is, or establishes, is some baseline rates, which then in future years will provide a point of comparison for, are things actually changing? And that's really part of our goal, is to set up the infrastructure to be able to determine, are things changing? Are things getting worse?
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ben Locke. He is Assistant Director of Research and Technology at the Center for Counseling and Psychological Services at Penn State, where he is also involved with the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health, which is based there at Penn State. And we're talking in part about the results of a pilot study that they just put out not too long ago, where they were in the process of trying to gather together data from a lot of college campuses across the country, looking at this issue of the students who go into the counseling center looking for help. Who are they? What kind of help are they looking for? And the ultimately, one of the questions they're trying to get at is this last question we were talking about is the issue getting worse? That is, are there more students who are seeking help than there have been in the past? We have a caller here and would welcome others, starting out with a caller in Champaign. This is our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
I guess I have a two-part question. I'm a professor, and I mean, I certainly have noticed over the years the sort of rising level of anxiety. And,
sure.
I mean,
sure.
I have a student in crisis at least once a semester in one of my classes. I'm curious to see, and it'll be interesting to see long term, to what extent is economic pressures contributing to anxiety and depression? I mean, I see a lot of students who are working really long hours, taking really high credit loads, feeling external pressures from parents about career choices.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to what extent does the data show students coming in, you know, because of the real, you know, sort of failure of financial aid and increase in cost. And two, to what extent are issues of sexuality, you know, masculinity, femininity, and also, you know, queer identity.
Sure.
To what extent are those predictive also of mental health crises?
Well, these are both excellent questions, and I would also say that the full report that we're talking about today is available online, and you can download it and kind of read the detailed answers. But to address your first question about economics, the timing of the data collection was the fall of 2008, up through December of 2008, which was kind of right as things were starting to happen economically. And we haven't really had an opportunity to dig into that portion of the data, but there is little question that as students experience increasing economic stress, that all aspects of their academic life become increasingly stressful and in crisis. One interesting thing that we have seen in the data is that we had two questions that asked about how much finances were a source of stress for students both growing up and then in present day. And one thing that's clear is that kind of a majority of students did not experience financial distress growing up, whereas today they do feel that they're under increasing levels of financial stress. And one of the goals of the project is to be able to monitor these kinds of issues in an ongoing manner. So when it's up and running, for example, we would be able to document as the financial ecosystem changes what then happens to mental health, and we could actually, you know, track that. With regard to things like gender, sexual orientation, I have some very interesting findings in this study. One of the components of a standardized data set is it's not just sexual orientation, heterosexual, lesbian, gay, bisexual, but also questioning. And the group of students who identify as questioning appear to be having a very unique set of experiences and under significant stress. And as an example of that, the quality of relationship that a student has with their family of origin is often viewed as being a moderator for things like depression and anxiety for students who have a minority sexual orientation. But for students who are questioning, actually, even having a positive relationship with a family of origin does not eliminate sort of the increased levels of depression. And so what this really illustrates to us is that when students are in a place where they're questioning their sexual orientation, when they're kind of in the middle, that's a very, very difficult period. And it's nice to be able to document that empirically. We know that through practice, but to document it empirically, and even to say that, you know, even if you have a great relationship with your family, that may not protect you against the experience of depression. So that's just one example of the data that we've looked at.
Thank you.
All right.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm looking here at the report and looking at the section where you're laying out the descriptive characteristics of, you know, the demographics of the people who are going in to seek counseling. And mm-hmm. one thing that's very striking, and perhaps it's not surprising because I think it's representative of the general population, is that there is much greater tendency of women to go in for counseling than men.
Yep.
Is there anything else that really, if you look at the various kinds of characteristics of the students that are going in looking for help, is there anything else that really stands out as being particularly descriptive of them?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think your first point here is a really important one, that men tend to underutilize mental health services. And you know, your previous caller's question about gender, you know, relates to this, it's not believed that men and women it is believed that they both suffer from mental health concerns. So the fact that men are not seeking help is concerning, but it is sort of the standard trend. One thing we did notice in here in terms of racial and ethnic breakdown is that, for example, students who identify as being white or Asian American appear to be perhaps overutilizing services based on their representation, whereas students who identify as being black or African American or Hispanic appear to be underutilizing mental health services. And it's not completely clear at this point whether that's a result of the schools who are able to contribute data at this point or whether that is a true reflection of underutilization.
Mm-hmm.
But that's certainly an area that we're going to be looking at.
I expect that one of the questions that people who work in the counseling field would ask, though, about that is what is the demographic makeup of the counselors? And is there mm-hmm. any relationship between the profile of the counselors and the profile of the students, and would it make a difference if students saw more counselors that they perceived of as being like them, with the idea that somehow if you're like me, maybe you'll have a little bit better understanding about what's going on with me?
Yeah, no, and this is a really important point. It is, you know, if you see faces that look like you in a setting, you're more willing to go into that setting by and large. And so it's part of the reason that counseling centers really value having a diverse and representative staff so that the students seeking services will be able to feel that kind of match. Now, a question that's up for debate as to whether or not actually matching a student results in better treatment. Probably unlikely, but the fact that students are willing to walk in the door is definitely influenced by the sense of I am represented here. And this also speaks to larger cultural issues, that cultures vary in terms of their opinion of mental health services, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, and whether it's acceptable or not acceptable to admit that you're struggling or to admit that you need help. And that does appear to play a role in whether or not people seek out services.
Mm-hmm. We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Ben Locke. He's executive director of the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health based at Penn State University. And we're talking about some of the results of a study that they did, trying to take a look at students across the country at colleges and universities, and they sampled more than 130 of them, including ours, trying to take a look at students who go into the counseling center for help and looking at what it is that's going on with them. And the idea is that what they're trying to do is move into the direction of having a better understanding, not just one campus and another campus, but better understanding broadly about what's going on with the mental health of college students here in the United States. Questions, comments, you're welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, one of the things from having read some stories about this and having had some conversations with people, that the perception perhaps I had was that one of the reasons, if the number of people seeking help is going up, that one reason is that we have students who are coming to university with some prior mental health issues the possibility that they had been in counseling before, the possibility mm-hmm. they had taken medication. And I guess
sure.
one of the things that I think is interesting, though, is that if you take a look at the section where the people who were coming in were asked questions about, had you been in counseling before, had you been on medication before, that actually almost half had never been in any kind of counseling before, and over half, 66%, said no, they'd never used any kind of psychiatric mm-hmm. medication. So, yeah. And I wonder if that was a surprising kind of finding, or that actually you'd say, well, no, that really doesn't surprise me, and I really didn't think that that was that much of a problem. That is, students who are coming to college already having some issues of long standing.
Right. Well, this perception is what appears to be driving the reports by counseling center directors, especially that it appears as if prevalence and severity are increasing. More students are coming to campus with a history of mental health treatment. And so on the one hand, these results are not terribly surprising. They actually confirm some previous research that we've done. But they really do, what's fascinating about these results is they really offer a very solid kind of generalizable baseline of the levels of mental health experience that students are coming to counseling centers with. So, you know, about 50% of the students seeking help at counseling centers have already been in counseling. About 34% have already been on psychiatric medications. About 9% have been psychiatrically hospitalized. And what you find in compared to some other research that we've done is that these rates run about 2 to 3 to 4 times higher than the general population. And they really underscore, I think, or highlight the really critical job that counseling centers do on campus, and in some ways the burden that they're under. When you have this level of previous treatment, it's likely that you're going to have a more complex case that you're coping with, and that resources really need to be there to support that level of need.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I guess, turning it around then if one says, okay, 49% had never had prior counseling experience, well, that means 51% did.
Yep.
And that you actually have this, I think you said 9% had previously been hospitalized, had prior psychiatric hospitalization. Now, that might not seem like a big number, but then you'd have to ask, well, okay, what number would we have gotten if we did this 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Is it true that the numbers of students coming to campus who have been in counseling, who have been on psychiatric medications, who have been hospitalized, that number is bigger than it would have been 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ago?
Right, exactly, and that's part of the goal of the project, is to set up an infrastructure so that we can actually track that. When you compare that particular number, this 9% previous mm-hmm. psychiatric hospitalization, to a study here that we did at Penn State about 2 years ago, the number in the general student body, and this was a well-done randomized sample with phone and web participation, was about 1.5% of the student body. So you're looking at the concentration of students coming into counseling centers with serious psychiatric histories as being, maybe 4 or more times higher than the general student body. And that's a real area of concern in terms of the demand, the burden that's placed on counseling centers to cope with. And I think one of the things that is changing is that as college becomes increasingly the default next step after high school, and as we have early diagnosis and effective treatment kind of wrap around services in secondary education that enables students to graduate and be eligible to go to college, the population of students in college is increasingly reflecting the general population, and that comes with the more typical rates of prevalence of mental health concerns and treatment and history.
Mm-hmm.
And colleges are not kind of equipped, in a sense, to provide the same services that secondary education does, because colleges historically have been oriented more around for those who are able and eligible and in a position to afford college have gone, and they've tended to be well-supported and stable and maybe not having these kinds of issues. So I think there is, as college becomes more common and more of the default, then the issues present in college will become more common and more of the default that we would see in the general population. Hmm.
Questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Ben Locke. He's Assistant Director of Research and Technology at the Center for Counseling and Psychological Services at Penn State. He's also Executive Director of the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health, which is based there at Penn State. And as we have explained, we're talking some about the results of a study that they did, trying to take a look at students who go in for counseling at mental health centers on college campuses across the country, and trying to get a sense of what's going on with the health of college students, mental health of college students. Questions are certainly welcome here on the show. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Another caller here in Champaign. This is line one. Hello?
Yeah, I just happened to turn in late. But anyway, whether you covered this question, what about graduate students, particularly students that are working toward a PhD or doctorate? Did you look at this particular segment at all compared to, the rest of, undergraduates?
Mm-hmm. We did, although we have yet to have time to actually dig into the significant differences between these two groups. But there's little question that graduate students have a qualitatively different set of life experiences, current life experiences and stressors than undergraduates, and that they do vary. That includes the kind of incidences of depression, anxiety, things like suicidality, but also things like financial stress, sort of developmental stage in life, beginning families, having children, and coping with finances frequently more independently. So that's certainly an area that we'll be digging into.
What about also, and I don't know if this is covered, what about international students?
Yes, some of the components of the report do look at international students. Another area that we look at are transfer students. And so, for example, one area in which international students were looked at in this report is that international students experience significantly higher levels of academic distress than non-international students. But what was interesting there is that their self-reported GPAs tended to be higher than United States students or non-international students. So although they're reporting higher distress, they're actually doing quite well in school. And so that's just one area of interest that we've looked at. We will be, digging into each of these more over time.
But, I've worked with international students, and sometimes what happens is that there's a reluctance to go in, In other words, mm-hmm. in another country. That kind of thing?
Absolutely. International students, are, first of all, they're in a different country. It may not be their primary language, and there are often very strong cultural mandates against talking about issues that are considered private or family-based, and so those are real impediments to students seeking services. In our sample, we had about 4% of the students reporting that they were international students.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, yep. Thank you. Well, just looking at the question, I guess I was struck by, if you take a look at, again, where you break out various characteristics about students and you look at their academic standing, that between the freshman year and the senior, the percentage of people seeking help starts to creep up, which mm-hmm. Would make you think, well, that perhaps the stress, the concern, the anxiety that comes with approaching your finish and having to go out and get a job mm-hmm. maybe is an issue. And then it really significantly drops down for the graduate and professional degree students, even below the level of freshmen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there are more freshmen, sophomores, than there are graduate students. Or, I mean, there's more freshmen than there are graduate students in the sample. But you're correct in the general observation that as the longer people appear to be in school, the more likely they are to seek services. And, you know, that kind of makes sense that although lots of students struggle with adjustment when they originally arrive on campus, that it may be as they're approaching graduation and major changes in friendship or changes in their major, that's often a source of crisis or where they will seek out support. And graduate students appear to be utilizing services at a lower percentage than these other groups, but they're also somewhat less represented.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you did was you looked at alcohol substance abuse,
mm-hmm.
and this is an issue that certainly in recent years has gotten a lot more attention on college campuses, among administrators, I'm sure, also
mm-hmm.
again in popular media as being something where there's a growing problem. And one wonders, particularly for the group of students that you're looking at, those people who are reporting that maybe they're having some psychological distress and they're actually looking for help, to what extent the overuse of alcohol and other things, it's not just something that they're doing because it seems like that's what people do, but you'd have to wonder, well, is there some self-medication going on here?
Well, there's a great deal of research on the relationship between substance use, broadly speaking, and mental health concerns, and they overlap, you know, significantly. In our data set, we had two areas of measurement around alcohol. One was a question related to binge drinking, essentially how many times have you engaged in binge drinking over the last 2 weeks. And then we had a second set of questions which looked at kind of consequences of alcohol use or excessive alcohol use. So, one example at the extreme end of things is that students who are reporting 10 or more binge drinking episodes in 2 weeks, so that's at least that's a very high level, about 50% of those have seriously considered suicide. And so that's a very striking and easily usable number for a counselor in session. If somebody comes in reporting this and, you know, they're kind of asked about this amount of drinking and they sort of brushed off and say, no, it's just something I do with my friends. It's not a big deal. You know, then we're actually able to kind of come back to them and say, well, actually, this is pretty serious and there are risks associated. You know, there do appear to be elevated risk for things like depression. As binge drinking increases, things like depression appear to increase. And one very clear relationship, at least in this data, is that each increment in the frequency of binge drinking resulted in a corresponding decrease in GPA and a corresponding increase in distress related to academics. So although students will say that, you know, everybody's doing it and, you know, it's pretty common, actually there appears to be a pretty clear relationship between drinking and academic performance. You know, one of the things that was interesting in the data is that when students were asked how often they had engaged in binge drinking during the last 2 weeks, approximately 58% of the students said none, not at all. Which really, I think, kind of goes against the norm, the commonly held belief that all students are out there binge drinking. And in this case, 60% of students are saying they did not in the last 2 weeks. And there is an impact of commonly held norm, when students believe that there's a norm, a peer-based norm that they need to adhere to be accepted and feel like they're doing the right thing, if that's in fact not true, then it's important that we get that out there, that it's not as common as they might think.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, and it's something that I think that administrators have discovered is that, first of all, if you sample students and you ask them, well, what do you think people are doing in terms of their drinking? And they seem to have this exaggerated notion of levels of drinking
mm-hmm.
and how
mm-hmm.
common binge drinking is. And it seems that one of the things that's actually been effective in trying to help rein that problem in is to say to students, well, actually, here's, you know, we know what you think is going on, but actually here's what's really going on, and that it's much less than you'd think. And that mm-hmm. actually tends to go some way to get at this behavior that is maybe reinforced by this idea, well, that's what everybody does. If you can say to them, well, actually, it's not what everybody is doing, and mm-hmm. that's something that that apparently has actually been shown to be effective in trying to reduce the amount of binge drinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in a variety of kind of harmful behaviors or risky behaviors, this would be referred to as social norming campaigns or establishing new social norms to combat the perception of an inaccurate social norm. And there's some debate as to how effective these campaigns are, but it seems kind of clear that if there is a commonly held belief that a norm exists but it is in fact false, that it is our responsibility as institutions of higher education to try to combat that and get the right information out there.
Hmm. How to what extent do students, when they do come in for counseling, say that they feel that whatever problems that they're having are interfering with their ability to do their academic work?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question and a complicated one to answer. Students vary greatly in the way that they report the experience of symptoms related to mental health issues, let's say, and they also vary in terms of their perception that something is impacting their work. And so ideally we would have truly objective data on that. What's clear in this data is that students are reporting their GPA. And while a self-reported GPA can be debated a little bit in terms of its accuracy, it's clear that as mental health issues accumulate, that they do directly impact students' GPA. And so this could be taken as a perception or a measure of their ability to function. A very commonly cited statistic by the American College Health Association in their survey of all health issues is that 42 to 43% of students, depending on which year you look at, report having felt so depressed during the last 12 months they found it difficult to function. Hmm. That's a very large number of students feeling that depression is impacting their ability to function. In a similar study that we did at Penn State a couple of years ago, we asked whether or not mental health issues or which mental health issues the students were having and were they interfering with their ability to function during the last 12 months. The most highly reported mental health related issue was anxiety or stress. About 46% of students saying that was impacting their ability to function, with about 18 to 20% of students saying that depression was impacting their ability to function. And so this kind of variation in the numbers really underscores the difficulty in measuring these kinds of issues, but it's clearly important to continue trying to do so.
And let me again introduce our guest for this hour, Focus 580, Dr. Ben Locke. He's Executive Director of the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health. It's based at Penn State. And we're talking about a survey that they did trying to gather data from campuses across the country, data on the students who went into the counseling centers and what was going on with them. Their idea was to try to make some steps in what is really an ongoing kind of project to get a better understanding of the mental health of college students across the country. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana for people who might like to call in. Toll-free 800-222-9455. One reason I think that there has been, particularly in the last couple of years, so much concern about student mental health has been the few but very serious incidents of violence mm-hmm. that have taken place that have certainly gotten a lot of attention. And perhaps because of that, one has an exaggerated idea about just how likely such a thing is and how prevalent it is. But certainly in those cases, questions have been raised about whether or not we had a system that could identify potential perpetrator before violence happened and thereby prevent that. One of the things that you did try to get at is to particularly to ask people about whether they had any fear of that they themselves might engage in some kind of violent act. And it seems like the vast majority of the people said no. But I'm interested in what you think about this issue of, is there some way that you can identify people who might have the potential for violence before they actually act on that potential?
Yeah, this is a great question, and clearly one that is a hot issue today. And let me just kind of preface my answer by saying that I think the very public tragedies that have occurred on college campuses during the last several years are really are rare events. They're tragic outliers of behavior on campus, and they don't represent the common form of violence and different forms of violence that are actually very common on college campuses, such as assault or sexual assault. And that tragedies will always occur, and they're not all avoidable. And so our goal in looking at the data here was to say, is there a role that counseling centers can help play in terms of trying to identify students who might be at risk for some kind of violence? And we don't want to engage in any form of profiling of students, but we want to give the counselors, the mental health professionals, the tools to be able to know when somebody that they're sitting with, that they might need to ask some more questions. So the piece you're alluding to here is an article on campus violence that we looked at where, as part of a number of other questions, students were asked to rate how much they agreed with the statement, "I'm afraid I might lose control and act violently." About 73%, the vast majority of students, did not endorse this question at all, and about 7% of students endorsed it fairly strongly at the high end. And so then what we did was we took a number of the other variables that we theorized could be predictors of that particular answer, and we looked at kind of what fell out. And what we identified there was that these students who strongly endorse this fear of losing control and acting violently tend to be male. They tend to have previously harmed another person, and they have a kind of cluster of other characteristics or symptoms, such as fear of a panic attack, having unwanted thoughts they can't control, nightmares or flashbacks, being irritable, having suicidal ideation, low academic motivation, and frequently getting into arguments. Mm-hmm. And while that group or that cluster of factors cannot be used to profile and is not a sort of an accurate predictor, each of those were statistically significant in their relationship with this fear of losing control and acting violently. So it starts to offer an idea of how counseling centers could play a role in trying to identify this as a potential risk. Mm. But this is not to say that that this kind of data would be used to identify a potential campus shooter in a reliable manner.
We have another caller in Champaign again, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I may have misunderstood, but I was doing something when you mentioned it. But I thought I heard you say that African-American students and I believe Hispanic or Latino students underutilize counseling services.
Right. And so that statement is drawn from a comparison of the percentages of these of the racial groups represented in our data set to the national data on the racial percentages in institutions of higher education. And so if in comparing those, students who identified as being white or Asian were present in our data set at percentages that are higher than their general population percentage in higher education, whereas students who identified as black or Hispanic were present at lower percentages in our data than the general student body percentages.
Excuse me, sir. Go on. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I was just going to say, and I'm referring to national data there, and our data here looked at 66 schools.
Okay, let me ask you this: do you account for that disparity, cultural factors, economic factors? Is there a reason for this underutilization as compared to other cohort student groups?
Well, we did touch on this a little bit. And it's hard to tell exactly why this disparity exists in our data, but there's a couple of hypotheses. One fairly straightforward one is that we don't have enough institutions that are HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, or predominantly Hispanic universities, which may make up some of these national figures in terms of the percentages. And so one of our goals in the coming years will be to recruit these schools into our project so that we can include their data. But the other component you mentioned there is culture, and I think culture certainly does play a role in whether or not students are willing to seek services on campus. And one of the components we discussed earlier is this idea of if somebody does not see themselves mirrored in the staff working in a counseling center, perhaps they may be less likely to come in. And this is why I think counseling centers put so much effort into valuing and trying to build diverse staff.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're coming to the point here. We have maybe about 5 minutes left, and certainly one of the things that I'd like to hear you talk about is how it is that people at counseling centers across the country are trying to meet the need, and whether you feel that there is a significant staffing issue, whether, in fact, counseling centers and colleges and universities have the people that they need to meet what mm-hmm. seems to be a growing demand.
Yeah. Well, this is a complex question, a great question, and let me answer this in a couple of pieces here. I think counseling centers on campus historically served more of a developmental counseling mission. In other words, supporting students through the normal developmental experiences that people have as they grow up into adults. And that includes the experience of depression and anxiety, relationship breakups. But that one of the things that has been happening is that college campuses are increasingly reflecting the general prevalence and severity numbers related to mental health. And so college campuses are correspondingly seeing increasing numbers of students with more severe forms of mental illness on campus. And that pressure is pushing counseling centers to move from a developmental counseling supportive model to a mental illness agency or treatment model. And that absolutely puts counseling centers in a bind where they have this existing demand for services around developmental counseling and support, which is part of the reason students are in college, is to, you know, develop as people. But then this really added burden of more severe and chronic forms of mental illness being present. And, you know, I once heard a consultant describe college and counseling psychological services as a black hole into which you throw money and achieve no effect. And I really felt that was a short-sighted way of looking at the issue, and maybe an answer that's aimed at hooking an administrator who wants to save money. You know, I think ultimately what is becoming clear is that the out-of-classroom experiences of students, including their mental health, has a direct impact on their ability to succeed academically at the university. And that we really need to, as a community of institutions of higher education, recognize this and not treat it as a black hole, but really treat it as this is a serious area of need that we need to apply funding and resources to meet the need. Mm. Almost any counseling center you talk to will say that they are underfunded and understaffed and not able to meet the need. And a great many counseling centers refer large numbers of students out into the community if they have a community because they simply can't accommodate them in-house. And so I think that part of the goal of this project is to give counseling centers comparable data, apples-to-apples comparison, that they can use to advocate for resources and services on each of their campuses by saying, here's our data in compared to the nation or when compared to the region, and we really do have a need that we can document and then use that to seek additional funding.
Yeah, I'm sure this is a difficult question, but I wonder, do you have some sense of across the country what the average ratio of counselors to students is?
Well, the kind of goal ratio is about one counselor per 1,500 students, I believe, which is set by IACS, International Accrediting Agency for Counseling Centers. And I think many counseling centers do not meet that standard, or many institutions don't meet that standard. But it's also somewhat unclear how accurate that standard is. So if in the course of this project we're able to determine that a given counseling center is in fact meeting the needs, the demand that the university has for mental health services, then maybe we can begin to move towards a more objectively established ratio for what counseling centers should have if they are going to meet both the developmental normative life event counseling as well as counseling for more established forms of mental illness on campus. And I think there is an active debate and healthy tension around is this the job of institutions of higher education to provide these services, as it has been decided that secondary education, it is their legal responsibility to provide services to enable students to graduate. And it's unclear if institutions of higher education are going to take on that burden.
We are at the point, I'm sorry to say, that we're going to have to finish. I have a caller we simply cannot take. But I do want to say that if people are interested in reading this study that we've talked about, this recent study coming from the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health, they can go to the website of the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health and take a look at it. It is available there. And also you can find out more about our guest. He is the executive director of the Center for the Study of Collegiate Mental Health at Penn State and also works at the Counseling Center there by going there to Penn State, to their website or to his website. Our guest is Dr. Ben Locke. Dr. Locke, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It was my pleasure.